Wildly naturally. It's great to be with you this evening and to be able to share a little bit with you about the work of Bible translation in Chad. We'll talk, as you see here, we'll talk a bit about who we are, present ourselves, and then what we do, what's our work, where we work, who do we work with. Then we'll talk a bit about our first term overseas, which was both in France for French study and then in Chad. We'll give a little overview of our time here in the States and then a summary of what our hopes are heading back to Chad, Lord willing, this spring.
So, we are Miriam. Just so you know, my voice tends to be a little louder than his, for better or for worse. Miriam and Josiah, and then we have six kids now, but this one pictured Titus is our oldest, and then we have Esther, Katarina, Edelette, Evsevia, and our littlest one is Silas. He's 5 months now.
This picture is outdated, but I left it in just so you can get a sort of picture of how we dress. This is a picture that we took just outside of town. And then here's a more updated picture of the family. So we work in the country of Chad, which, as you can see there, highlighted in yellow, is kind of smack dab in the middle of the northern part of Africa. It's a landlocked country, no coast. Most of the country, most of the northern two-thirds of the country really is in the desert, part of it into the Sahara Desert. And it's a very diverse country in terms of climate from north to south. In the south, it's much more fertile. The northern part is mostly Muslim. In the south, there's a mix of Christian, Muslim, animist, culturally very distinct. In the south, they're able to plant fields. In the north, it's mostly animal husbandry. So there's a big divide in the country from north to south in many aspects. You can see here the size of the country from north to south is about just over 1,000 miles, 1,085, I think, is what I measured. And to put that in perspective, that's about from the northern border of the United States down to close to Dallas, or from the southern part of Maine to the northern part of Florida, or on the west coast from, I think that's Vancouver, down to San Diego or so. So it's a huge country from north to south. Lots of different language groups in the country. I think the estimate is somewhere around 120 distinct languages. Most of those are concentrated in the southern part of the country. So we work in the north, where there are just a few languages that cover the whole northern half. In the southern half of the country, there are over 100 languages, much smaller languages. We both grew up in the country of Niger, which is just to the west of Chad. And some of you knew Miriam when she was a child growing up there. Yeah. I grew up in the same country. And our families overlapped for about 9 years in the country before we met. So we were both young children, infants when we moved there, and we were, I think, 14 years old when we finally met. Yeah. You may remember Miriam more at this stage. I don't know if anyone can pick out which one she is there.
Anyone want to take a guess? Huh?
Not no. In purple.
Multicolored dress. Yeah.
Yeah. And then this is a picture of my family from about the same era. I'm in the front there with the dark blue, dressed how we dressed in Niger. So we're working in Chad, and the focus of our work is Bible translation work. So we're translating the scriptures into a local language, which is called Dazaga. And it's a language that's spoken in the northern half of the country. It's about, I think it's the fourth or fifth largest language in the country, with about a little over 500,000 speakers. So the focus of our work is to translate the scriptures into that language so that they have the scriptures in a form that they can understand. So the scriptures don't come to us in Dazaga or in English or in French. They come to us in Hebrew, Aramaic, and in Greek, but that doesn't do much good for most of us. It's literally Hebrew and Greek to us. So the scriptures must be translated to be understood. Here's a picture of an edited text. So the scriptures go from manuscripts to edited editions, like the Hebrew text you see here. And then from that, in most translation projects, they'll go from Hebrew or Greek through a major language like English or French into the local languages there. So in Chad, that would be French, would be an in-between language for people who haven't studied biblical languages. And the goal is to go from the biblical languages through French or Arabic in some cases into the local language. And here you see Luke 1, 22 and 23 in Greek, and then on the bottom in Dazaga. So that's the goal, is to bring the scriptures into a form that people there can read or hear if they're illiterate, that they can hear in recorded form so that they'll be able to understand the gospel. A bit about translation. This is a text from 1 Corinthians 14, 10. Can't read it on that screen. Let's see. Paul says, "There are doubtless many different languages in the world, and none is without meaning. But if I do not know the meaning of the language, I will be a foreigner to the speaker, and the speaker a foreigner to me. So with yourselves," he says, "since you are eager for manifestations of the Spirit, strive to excel in building up the church." So that's our goal at this point, when they hear the scriptures in another language that they can't understand. God is like a foreigner to them. They can't understand the speech of the scriptures. And so to bridge that gap, make it understandable so that they're no longer foreigners, but able to understand the word of God and be reconciled to him, to build up and plant the church there. In Acts 2:11, similarly, when the apostles are speaking, everyone gathered there in Jerusalem who heard them on the day of Pentecost, it says, heard them speaking the mighty works of God in their own tongues. So that's our hope, is that through our work, the people there in Chad, the speakers of Dazaga will be able to hear of the mighty works of God in their own tongue. So translation is our focus. We also, in the town where we live, we have, there's an education center that we're associated with. So we have a presence, a work there that's more easily understandable and identifiable for the people in the community. So we spend some time involved with the education center, teaching English, French, and computer classes. So we'll talk now a bit about our first term overseas, which was about 3.5 years. And started out with French study.
So we started out in a town in the valley in the French Alps called Albertville, which is near the Swiss border, near Geneva. And we attended a school there. But Josiah and I had some French, a little bit of French from growing up in Niger, but we needed to get better at it. So we started at, in 2019, January 2019, we started at French school and ended in 2020. The place that we went to is a school specifically for missionaries to learn French. So the professors there see it as their ministry to teach missionaries so that those missionaries can then go out. So it's a really unique school. And they do things that you wouldn't find in a university, like doing a biblical vocabulary. They have a whole class on, you know, what and how to pray in French and that sort of thing. So that was a big encouragement to us. And this is a picture of Josiah's class towards the end of our time there. We had a lot of late nights after the kids were in bed. Josiah says, "I'm not a night person or a morning person." So this was a bit of a struggle for me, but the Lord helped us through that. So that's just a picture of us studying. The kids attended public school, and that was a big leap for us, going from homeschooling to not only public school, but public school all in French. So it was a bit of a difficult transition the first month or so for the kids, but the Lord granted us and them a lot of grace, and they did well. And by the end, they were thriving, and most of them fluent within their context of French. And they had some really wonderful teachers. The Lord blessed us that way.
So with COVID and borders shutting down, we ended up being stuck in France for some extra months. But then eventually, as borders opened back up in the fall of 2020, we were able to get our visas. We had to actually go to across to Switzerland to get visas to go to Chad. And then we're able to finally head out for Chad the last day of October in 2020. So, Chad, this is a picture directly out our front gate, looking kind of across a small valley up onto another sand of the three main sand dunes that the town is built on. You can see some of our neighbors' houses across the way. We started out, though, in the capital city called N'Djamena, and we spent about 6 months there. Part of that was to get paperwork. We had to get long-term visas. We have to get special paperwork, which we have to renew every 3 months to be allowed to travel outside of the capital city. We also spent some of that time studying Chadian Arabic, which is the second national language in Chad. And we just studied it for about 2 months or so just to get a very basic level of Chadian Arabic to be able to use in the market or to get a taxi or to give directions, to have greetings, that sort of just basic functionality. So we spent time studying Chadian Arabic. And then as well as just kind of settling into life in Chad, figuring out life there, starting to adapt to the culture, the climate. And since my parents were there during part of that time, and my mom was willing to homeschool our children, we went ahead and started some Dazaga, which is the language into which we're translating. So we spent a few months starting Dazaga while we were still in the capital city. This is a picture of the house. There are houses on either side, and then in the back you see a house, which is the house we ended up renting while we were in the capital city. And you can see our team leader there standing on his vehicle, taking a picture of the roof, and that's to try to figure out where and how we could situate solar panels. Even in the capital city, there's pretty intermittent electricity, so we'd have maybe one day of electricity, one day off, and so it's good to have some solar panels for backup. So we were there about 6 months, and then actually here are some pictures of our house, some better pictures on the other side of the shrubs. You can see a bit of the building style. Rooms tend to be quite separated. There's usually a room for the husband, a room for the wife and kids, a visiting room. The kitchen is a separate building off of the house. Here's homeschooling out on the porch. Generally, people don't have furniture as we would conceive of it. They'll have mats, rugs on the floor, maybe pillows, and you sit or lounge on the floor. This is a typical sort of living room setup with various multicolored cushions, rugs, lots of clashing patterns and colors. In May of 2021, after we'd been there about 6 months, I traveled up to Mussoura, which is the town where we live, and started looking for a house. There are no realtors per se, so you have to know somebody who knows somebody who knows what's going on with houses in the area. And we found someone who did know and looked at a number of houses and ended up renting this house here, which has been a great provision for us. It's a fairly large house. So it gives us the room that we need, gives us the room to have some more private living areas and then some parts of the house that are more open to receive visitors or to do language study. Also has some trees in the yard, which is a great bonus. And so it's been a blessing for us that the Lord's provided. This is our U-Haul equivalent, heading up to Mussoura from N'Djamena, packed up all of our belongings and then drove up in this truck. Once we arrived in Mussoura, we had to reinstall. We had uninstalled the panels that we installed in N'Djamena, had to reinstall them here. Mussoura is a fairly large town, about 50 to 75,000 people, and it's actually the provincial capital, but there's only water in a couple of neighborhoods from the city. Everyone else has to have a well to get water. And there's no city electricity, so if you want electricity, you have to have a generator or solar panels. So we run off solar, which in the Sahara Desert works pretty well. This is a picture of the road up, or part of the road up from the capital up to where we live. So the first about 2 hours, it's roughly a five-hour drive. For about two and a half hours, it's paved, and then at a certain point, you just turn off the road, and there's tracks you follow up to where we live. There is a video here. I don't know if it'll play. It just gives kind of a, it shows us driving, and will give a bit more of a feel of what the road and travel is like. I think it's actually, it's the next slide. Here it is. I don't know if you can play it from the back there. If it doesn't work, that's fine. It just, that's wind. So you don't have to worry about traffic, but the you do have to worry about stumps, or you know, the, you have to make quick decisions about which track you're going to take when it splits off, and watch out for goats and that sort of thing.
So this is our hot season sleeping setup. We have three seasons really. We have our hot season, or our summer. Which starts in April, which is like April, May, June. And then our rainy season, which is end of June, July, August, and beginning of September. And then we have another mini hot season, and then we have our winter. So hot season, we sleep outside. We have pop-up mosquito nets because malaria is prevalent there, so we have these really cool little pop-up mosquito net tents that also have a bottom to them to keep other critters out. We don't have a lot of scorpions and things like that, but we do have enough to where we just like to keep them out. It gets pretty hot, so we kind of have to choose whether we want outside cooler temperatures. Usually by 1 a.m. or so, the temperatures will be down to mid 80s. And so we can get a little bit of sleep early in the morning, but we don't really have any airflow, or there's sleep inside where temperatures usually stay in the 90s throughout the night, but we have fans. So depending on how we feel, we opt for one or the other. And this particular hot season, we were outside most nights. And then this is rainy season. Before each rain, during rainy season, there's a big sandstorm that comes through. I don't know if you can see it very well in the picture. There's usually a sandstorm that comes through for about maybe 15 to 20 minutes before the rain. It's just the wind kicking up the dust. And that's Evsevia in the picture, and she is super excited because rain is coming. And it can drop the temperature from 110, 115 degrees to mid to low 70s. So we can easily get a 40-degree drop within about 30 minutes. And it feels great, and the kids are usually asking for hot chocolate because they're frigid. So, the kids, I think that's one of the biggest things they miss about being in Chad is rainy season, because it's just fun, warm rain that they can play in, and it's great.
So we have a team in Musro, which is ourselves, another family, and two single women. And they've been a huge help to us as we moved there, helping us get set up, helping us learn the ropes with how to get visas and various paperwork, where to go shopping, connecting us with friends of theirs who can help us out with various things. And so this is a picture of our team. The Shoofs, the other family, have three girls, roughly the same age range as our girls, and that's been a lot of fun for them to have friends there. And they now have a young son, just a few months older than our son, Silas. So that's another nice blessing. This is the local church in Musro. There's just one Protestant church in town. And so this is where we go on the Lord's Day, gather here with other believers. They're all people from the south of Chad. So everyone pretty much in Musuro, everyone who's from that area who lives there is Muslim, and this church is people who have come from the south of Chad, moved up for work or to be with family for other reasons. And so it's almost like it is really a third culture. We have our team culture, a bunch of Americans, and then everyone else in town who are northerners, Muslim, and then there's this group of southerners who dress very differently, speak different languages, they're Christians. On Sunday we have this third little culture that we're a part of. And even though there are big differences in culture, big differences in language, differences in the way we do church, it's been a blessing to be able to gather with them as brothers and sisters to worship the Lord, to hear the word preached together on Sundays. This is a picture of a meal we had with the pastor and his wife. And in the foreground is a younger Chadian missionary who also is from the south, but has moved up as a missionary to the northern part of Chad, to the more Muslim area. And talking about cultural differences, generally among northerners, men and women are very separate. They wouldn't eat together as a family. Men eat in one area, women in another. Almost all of life is separate in that way. But this is with a pastor and his wife from the south, and as believers, we're able to share a meal as a family with another family, and that's another aspect that's really nice about being part of that community. You want to say anything else about that?
No, just that, I mean, it's been a particular encouragement to me to have this, because I think this was the only meal, aside from our team meals, this was the only meal that we ate the entire time we were there as a family outside of our home, because men and women live separate lives. And so it's an encouragement to me to be able to hang out with everybody together and all have the same experience, because it just, it takes on a whole new meaning when you ask somebody, well, how'd your day go? You really, because you live kind of separate lives outside of the home.
Thinking now, just kind of categorizing some of the main tasks of our day-to-day life. A major part of our first term especially has been language learning, first French, then some Chadian Arabic, and now in living in Musuro, learning Dazaga, which is the language into which we'll be translating. And the purpose, of course, of learning languages is to be able to communicate with people around us, to be able to share the gospel, and also then to be able to translate the scriptures into that language. We use, I mentioned, French, Arabic, Dazaga. We use various languages in various settings. Language is really a key part of our ministry there. So in the family, we use English. Sometimes we use some French, especially as we're trying to help the children keep their French. With our neighbors, we speak mostly Dazaga, but sometimes there will be a neighbor who will speak Arabic, sometimes French, so we use a mix of languages there. With the government, I'm generally working just in French. At church, it's mostly French, but then the sermon is translated into Arabic, and there are generally each Sunday there will be one language group in the church, because the church has people from multiple language groups within the church, and generally one language group will have a special time on any given Sunday where they will sing some songs in their language, but mostly church is French and Arabic. With our colleagues, we speak French, English with Americans, or French. So there's, again, a mix of languages. If we're going to the market, if we're going around town in a taxi, we'll speak Dazaga generally in Musuro. In N'Djamena, it's much more likely that we'll speak Arabic, or sometimes in the market and to get a taxi, you can speak French. So we spend a lot of time on language learning, but it's a key part of what we do and varies a lot from in the different domains of life. Translation, then, of course, is another facet. There we're working ultimately from Hebrew and Greek, but then through French is the most widely spoken language in terms of a language of wider communication, and into Dazaga, but then with reference to other translations like Arabic, other French translations. So that, again, is a mix of multiple languages for that part of our ministry. So language learning, another big aspect of our time there has been building relationships as we move into the community, getting to know our neighbors, making contacts in town as we go into the market. Here's a picture of children over at our house playing with our children. So building relationships in our community, in the town, and then, as I mentioned, also at the local church with people who are not the focus of our ministry, but who are believers in town and encouragement to us, and we hope to be an encouragement to them as well. Another aspect of our work there is, as I mentioned, education. We have a small role. I've been doing some administrative stuff for the education center in Musuro. And it's a small education center that teaches English, French, and computer classes. We do a little bit related to language development. My training, much of my training has been in linguistics, and so being involved some in literacy work. I was giving a presentation on verb systems in a couple of languages at a writing contest where they had some classes. So I'm involved to a small extent in that work as well. Thinking now about our current time in the States, which is called furlough or HMA, home mission assignment. So this time back in the States is a time, first of all, we came back a bit early for the birth of our son, Silas. So normally we would have been overseas for about 4 years. We came back after 3.5 so that we could be here in the States for his birth. And we're grateful for a safe birth and that went smoothly. It's also a time to visit with family. I think I mentioned that my folks were there in Chad for a few months while we were there, but otherwise we don't see family when we're overseas. So to be able to come back to see family has been a great part of being here in the States. I think we met, on our return, I think we met 8 or 9 new nieces and nephews that we hadn't met that had all been born while we were gone. And just to see, particularly for Miriam, her parents again, her father had some major health crises while we were gone, and to experience those from a distance without being able to be there was very difficult for her. So to be back with him and to be able to see him has been a sweet encouragement for her. It's also a time when we get to visit with those who partner with us in the work. We travel around, of course, sharing at things like this, meeting with supporters, friends. And that's a very important aspect of our time back in the States. Thinking a bit about what the role of partners is. Paul says, this is from Romans 10. He asks a series of questions, and it's actually, if you look at it, it's in reverse order chronologically. So he starts at the end, and he says, how then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? So he asks this series of questions. If we pull out the verbs there, you see there are 5 of them in this sequence. If you look at what's the subject and object of these verbs? Who's doing what? You see that it starts with someone sending someone else. So without someone sending someone to go, no one's going, no one's hearing. So this process starts with someone sending, and the person who is sent then has to go and be faithful to preach, to translate, to share the gospel. And it's as that happens, as our partners do their role, as we do our role, that people are then able to hear, to believe, and to call on the Lord. So to be with our partners in the work is a sweet part of our time here back in the States. Paul talks about this partnership both in terms of giving, which is something that people often think of, support in terms of financial giving, but he also talks about it in Romans 15 in terms of striving with him in prayers. He sees prayer for his work as itself a work, a striving, an important component of partnership. 3 John, the writer characterizes those who partner with others in the work of gospels as fellow workers for the truth. So to be able to come back to the States and meet with those who are fellow workers with us in this work is very important to us. Another aspect of our time here in the States is rest It's not necessarily physically restful. We travel a lot, but just to be back in the States in our own culture, speaking English with our family, being able to do things that we don't generally get to do overseas, like take family walks or go cycling or various things like that, that just culturally we don't do when we're overseas. It's very nice to be able to be back in the States and do those kind of things. There's a lot of administrative stuff that has to be taken care of when we're here in the States, whether doctor visits or meetings with our mission, aspects like that to our time here. So thinking now, in finishing up here, about our return to Chad, Lord willing, we'll head back in at the end of March, toward the end of March or early April and of this year. And we would plan to return to Musra, where we've been working, to the same house, the same team and community, to carry on our work there. The main focus of our first term was language learning, and that will continue to some extent. We have the language learning program that we use is designed for learning a language that is not necessarily written, as Dazaga is. There is an official writing system, but very few people know about it. Very few people who speak the language are literate, and so it's not really a written language practically in most senses. So this method is designed to learn a language like that, where there are no textbooks, there's no class, no teachers. It's a method designed to sit down with a native speaker of the language and learn one-on-one. And it's about a 3-year program overall. So we completed the first year of that, and as we head back, I just started the second year before we returned. My hope would be to finish up that second year, and then as I move into the third year, hopefully be at a point where we can start the actual translation work. It's likely that there's been some translation into this language done in Niger, but none of it's been published. It's at various stages of rough draft, needs revision, and it's in a different dialect as well. But as we start the translation work, our goal would be to take something that's already been brought to a certain point, rough drafted, maybe even revised, adapt it to our dialect where we live in Chad, and then go through the various processes of revision, testing, consultant checking that need to be done to get it to the point of publication. So that's looking ahead to this next term. Lord willing, we'll get into that, the actual process of translation as we advance in our language learning. All right, we have some time for questions, and I've just thrown up on the screen here some of the things we covered might jog your memory about questions you have. We'll be happy to answer your questions. Yes?
Do you use the computer a lot in translate? Does it help you, like you say, with Wycliffe, to use different computer things that have helped you? And then,
right, yeah, we do use computer a lot. I use software, for instance, like Logos Bible software is really helpful to me because I can have books electronically, which is very practical when we're moving back and forth. I can't move a huge library with me, but I can have a large library on my computer, which is also then easily searchable, has Hebrew, Greek texts, commentaries, Bible dictionaries, French translations, etc. But then there is specific translation software called Paratext that's designed for inputting and editing translation, and it also has parallel resources like a French text that you can compare, biblical language texts. So there's software like that that's designed to facilitate the translation process as well as the revision and testing. It allows you to do consistency checks and check parallel passages to see if you've translated them the same way. So that kind of software does help in the process of translation.
Other question.
Her second question. They're open to talking about it generally. So it's a Muslim area. People there believe in God. They believe in that there's one God who created the world. They believe that people are sinful, not necessarily in the same way as we would define it. So there are a lot of, at least on the surface, what seem to be commonalities, and so they tend to be very open to talking about those kind of things. I wouldn't say that they're open to the gospel per se. the core of the gospel is the death and resurrection of Jesus, as that applies to sinners. And it's right there in terms of the identity of Jesus, his death, and so forth, where there's the biggest difference between Islam and Christianity. So they're resistant to that, but they are open to talking, at least in general.
So how much time? You can't just sit and do the translation then all day, right? Because you're supposed to be over there to be helping them at that language center. You know, how much are you able to be open about what you're there to do? So are you doing translation work in the cracks, or are you spending a good part of your days doing that?
We haven't really started the translation yet because we're still focused on language learning. And until I reach a point where I'm good enough in the language, we won't start the translation. And even at that point, I'll always need to have native speakers of the language involved, because I'll never be perfectly fluent or know all the nuances to get the translation natural. We actually spend very little time at the education center. It's probably no more than maybe an hour a week or so, just with some minor administrative tasks. The bulk of our time is spent in language sessions and then just visiting people, things like that, building
so
relationships.
Okay with that in the Muslim thing of you being there to just translate scripture?
I think most people don't know that we're translating scripture or there to translate scripture. They know that we're believers. We're very open about that. They see us walking across town to church and so they know we're believers, and some people, I think, are probably hostile towards us to stay away from us because of that, but generally people aren't too hostile towards us. Most people are very friendly, open, even though they would disagree with us, of course, in terms of our beliefs.
That is one of the difficulties about Bible translation, is finding not only people who are qualified to work, who are literate, who speak French, because the native speakers will be working from a French translation, and then Josiah will be working with what they translate into their own language. He will be checking with the Hebrew and Greek. So we need helpers there, but you need someone who's literate enough in French to be able to do that, and not only someone who's literate enough, but someone who's also willing to do the translation. And that's something that you can pray for, because we need someone willing enough to associate with us to be able to do that. So it'd be one thing if we're doing Bible translation, that's one thing. But then native speakers who then are working with us, they then receive a lot of hostility for doing that. Right.
Was there another question? Yeah.
What do the neighbors think you're there for?
They understand that we're associated with this education center, so that's kind of a concrete thing that they see and understand easily.
You're there an hour a week.
Yeah, but
what do they think you're doing the rest of the time?
Part of that is about expectations. Work weeks there are very different. Most people don't have steady jobs. If you have a government job, you might go in a few days a week, sit around, do some stuff at the office, but they don't expect anyone to be working 8 hours a day during the work week. So nothing seems out of the ordinary to them in that sense. They know that we're learning the language. They know that we're believers. They know that we share with our language helpers, with our other friends, about what we believe and what the scriptures teach. We are not at the point where we're actually translating, and I think most people don't know that that's specifically why we're there. Yes.
I've noticed that you're dressed at different times with different, like being at your house or whatever, versus maybe being with other people. Is that due to the Muslim culture, that to go out and be amongst them, you're expected to dress in
way? Yeah. It's not particularly related to Islam. Anyone from that culture, from that area, whether they're believers or not, dresses the same way, more or less. Some of the women will dress more conservatively with the full burqa, and you wouldn't see a Christian dressing that way, but the Christian women veil themselves. The Christian men still wear the jalabiya robe and the turban. So it's mostly, if I'm in our compound itself, then I'll wear sometimes just a T-shirt and the drawstring pants that they wear. If I go out of the compound at all, I'll wear the jalabiya, put on my turban, if I'm going out to walk around town or visiting. So it's kind of that context of in the home or in our compound or outside more than anything to do with Islam or... They wouldn't be terribly surprised, I think. They've seen other Westerners, especially in the capital city, U.S. embassy personnel, French military, they dress like they do in the States or in France. They wear shorts, T-shirt, whatever. But they really appreciate it, particularly for the women, but even for the men, they see it as dressing respectably. If I were to walk around in shorts, they would think they would not look on us highly at all. Or if Miriam were to walk around unveiled, they would, yeah, not look on us well. Yeah, so growing up in Niger, that was certainly very helpful for us, particularly, I think, in terms of setting expectations. So when we moved to Chad, Chad is very similar to Niger in many ways, and so the expectations we had in terms of what daily life would be like, what things would be hard, what things would be nice, were pretty accurate going back, even though our experience was as children, as teenagers. It's different being an adult with your own family, certainly, different responsibilities. But those expectations, having more or less accurate expectations going in was very helpful. We didn't really feel much culture shock moving there, and there wasn't too much that was overwhelming. So I think that was very helpful in giving us a smooth transition. And then in terms of corruption, it is a big problem. The president and his family pretty much give out jobs, offices, positions to their family. Anyone in power sees that as sort of a right then to use that position to extort money if they need it for their families. So it is a big problem and all over the country. And Chadians don't like it, but they see it as kind of if you're going to get anything done, you're just going to have to go along with the system as it exists. But there's a lot of discontent with it. Yeah.
Really living questions. Where do you shop? How do you get there? Taxi all the time? Do you have your own vehicle? What do things cost? If someone wants to move there because of inflation here in the high, your house, can I ask, how much would it cost to rent that house?
It costs us about $500 a month to rent. The cost of living is certainly cheaper, but the quality often matches the price. So, yeah.
You want to talk about? Shopping wise, it's all open market. Food wise, meat, open air, vegetables, open air, dried beans, a lot of dried stuff. the market is about a 30-minute walk. We do not have a vehicle. So it takes about 30 minutes to walk to the market. I have a woman who I pay to go to the market and do the shopping for me. I can do it if she's sick or something like that, but it takes a huge load off of me. It's about a 30-minute walk, and then with my language skills, it would take me probably about 2 hours because you have to barter for the things. And then there are motorcycles that you can hire to bring you back with all your groceries. But they're really not very safe. They don't drive very well. They drive really fast, and then they hit a patch of deep sand, and they're doing this, and then sometimes they'll fall over. So I'm not really keen on riding them. The cost of food is also very, very cheap. But then what they get, their daily, their salary is either nothing because they don't have work, or, for instance, the woman that we pay to help me with shopping, she also hand washes all of our laundry and that sort of thing. We pay her an excellent salary, and that's $1 an hour. So cost of living is low, but so is...
That supports her, and then she sends money back to support her family with that.
Yeah.
Question here, and then in the back.
And then back there, too.
Two questions, if I could. One's of a more technical nature. Are you typically using one Hebrew text and one Greek text, or are you drawing from different ones? And then which do you use? Just curious.
So one Hebrew text, typically just the standard BHS text. And for Greek, I use just the standard Nessie Allender UBS text.
And then I think the church has often put pressure on missionaries to project success, or we focus a lot on the work. But it was really, I had a really neat moment a couple of years ago talking with a missionary who said, being a missionary is hard. And you know, he didn't say it in a complaining way, but just kind of, there's a lot that goes into it that people don't readily understand. So if someone were praying for you here, what would you want them to know about some of the emotional challenges, the personal challenges? I don't want to ask you to divulge too much, but just maybe some of the things that are discouraging, things that are challenging, things that are hard that we could be keeping in mind beyond obviously praying for the work, but then praying for you as individuals. What would you want somebody to know?
Yeah, so when people pray for missionaries, I think the first thing that comes to their mind is the work, and that makes sense. But like any believer, often our biggest problems are ourselves, our own sin, struggles in the family, our marriage. Those are the kind of things that people might not remember to pray for, but we're people, we're sinful human beings saved by grace who need the prayers for those kind of things as much as any believer. So those things would maybe often be forgotten, but are just as necessary and important for us, for our life as a family, and really for our longevity on the field, that those things, that we grow in grace in our own lives as a family, with our children, in our marriage. So those would be key aspects for prayer.
Yeah, I second that. I think parenting is a big one. Parenting in our marriage, and in an area where, we're trying to raise children to be godly children who can integrate into the culture that we're in and be culturally appropriate and be a testimony for Christ, but also be able to transition well back into the United States when it's their time. So that's always a struggle for us.
Question in the back. Yeah, so at this point, Chad is very open. We get our visas actually by invitation from one of the Chadian denominations. They'll send us an invitation letter. We submit that with our visa application, and our visas are just religious visas. So at this point, it's still very open in terms of the government. And that's really reflective, I think, of the situation. The government is mostly made up of Muslim people, but it's technically a secular government. And there's really no government persecution of Christians. There is persecution of Christians, but it generally comes from mainly and most severely from their own families, their own communities. So from the government side, we don't really have any trouble at all. I wouldn't say we get any negative political or social pushback or pressure on us in terms of what we're doing. There is, politically, there is growing anti-French sentiment across West and Central Africa. And so far that hasn't been a problem for us, but as in some cases there have been riots and other things that we try to stay away from because they're not going to, looking at us, they're not going to know if we're French or American. They may not take the time to stop and ask us. We do dress differently because most expats who are not missionaries dress like Americans, like French, like Germans. We dress like they do. And so I think that would be helpful in that kind of situation where we would blend in with them more or certainly at least be distinct from other expats. So we try to be careful in situations like that, not to go places where there are riots, not to get caught up in that kind of thing. But so far we haven't felt too much danger or pushback politically or socially.
And as far as our security in other areas, like the pastor was just saying this morning, wasn't, talking about us being missionaries. We try not to post things on the internet. If there's a live stream at a church, we don't use those words. Not for our safety. As Josiah said, we can still get in the country on religious visas, but it's for the Chadian believers that associate with us, who receive severe persecution from their families. Their families will, some have tried to kill them, or they have their children taken from them. So the security level that we use is not so much for our protection as it is for the local believers. How long do we?
Do you ever have issues with water, like living in the desert?
That's a good question. So we are in the desert. It's just sand everywhere where we are, but there's water. Seems like everywhere. People drill wells all over in villages, all throughout town. There are wells drilled. We have a well in our yard, and there seems to be plenty of water. We've never had issues with water running out, and it's pretty good, clean water coming up through the sand. It's kind of naturally filtered, I think. So far, that's not been a problem. Anytime we've had problems with it, it's related to the solar pump or leak in the pipe, that kind of thing, not the water supply itself. I think our well is about 30 yards down, 30 yards deep. I'm not sure how that compares to a typical well in the States.
We were 300 feet in New Hampshire.
Okay.
Yeah, our access to water is not, if we run out of water, it's usually because our solar pump doesn't work anymore. And then Josiah spends a day or two trying to fix it. Somebody asked me if it was a learning curve for me to be on solar. Not really for me, because I don't do any of the electrical work or the plumbing work. It's all him, but so is a big curve for him, I think. But we keep three barrels full of water in case our pump does stop working, and then we just really conserve on water until, Lord willing, our pump starts working again. And we also have a lot of neighbors who rely on us for water because they don't. There are wells with hand pumps throughout the town, but we're closer than the closest hand pump to a lot of our neighbors, and it's just a lot easier for them to hook a hose up to our hose and fill up barrels that way than them lugging buckets back and forth from the pump in the street.
Back here.
Question.
Yeah, that's a major issue in translation. It's related. So languages that are like Greek or English, German, French, those are all part broadly of Indo-European languages, and those kind of languages tend to have more abstract nouns, things like love or peace. And languages like Dazaga often don't have those same words or don't have them at least in noun form. Maybe it's a verb that expresses that. And so that does take a lot of work to figure out what we call key terms and to figure out how those can be expressed in that language. So that's a major part of the translation process, is pinning down especially the key terms, things like righteousness, salvation, peace, love, to try to get those right in the language as we carry on the translation work.
On the other hand, there can be easier vocabulary when it comes to other things, like with animal husbandry, or their climate is a lot more similar to what it was in the Old Testament. So they can have a better understanding sometimes of what life, like when in the Old Testament, just something that we don't really understand. Okay, well, why would they do it that way? They have actually a lot better understanding of that than we do because they live it.
like, for instance, Job's wealth being calculated in number of animals, that doesn't immediately click for us necessarily. We know it's a lot, but what does that actually equal to them? It's directly how they would calculate their wealth. Here and then over here.
Oh, sorry.
Just a question for Miriam. How do you adjust to being a woman living in an Islamic culture?
It's a good question. I am very thankful to the Lord that I have a childhood. My childhood was in a Muslim country. So I'm able to bring that along with me, and it wasn't as much of a learning curve. It's not really too bad in the sense that I don't feel really oppressed or anything like that. I have a husband who I know loves me and who treats me really well. And we also, in our marriage, we're trying to find ways in the cultural boundaries that we can push and that won't be off-putting to people. And things like people seeing him wash the dishes for me. Okay, that's a labor of love. He does that for me because he loves me. And whereas there, he did that one time when our house helper was around, he and our other teammate, who's a man, and our house helpers were like, they cannot do the dishes. It's okay, we'll do those. And I just had to stop him and say, no, they love me. They love, you know, my husband loves me as a wife, teammate loves me as a sister in Christ, and this is their way of serving us, not just me, but you guys as well. And so there are those cultural boundaries that we can push, which is great. But then there are other cultural boundaries like dress and just ways that I show respect to my husband that we don't feel like we can cross because that would just be really off-putting. So I don't know how well that answered your question, but overall, it's not a huge transition for me, I think, because I grew up with it. And then the dress, which I went and got this out of the car because someone had a question. I forgot to pull this out. I can put this on. You get used to it. And it actually, I don't know if Josiah answered this question earlier, it can become helpful for protection from the sun, as well as if you get caught in a dust storm, you can put it over your face. It keeps you from the dust. So there are practical aspects of it. And I get to a point where I actually feel uncomfortable without it. Because if I walk out of my house and I don't have it on, I feel very conspicuous and very out of place. And so you just get to the point where you're comfortable with it. Yeah.
Question? I would say maybe my language helper kind of has, and that's because we've spent a lot of time together, hours and hours, and talking, and sometimes he'll quote verses from the Quran and explain something and try to, he's not overtly, but seems to be kind of trying to promote Islam, and we've had a lot of really good conversations, coming down to really identifying the difference between Islam and Christianity, talking about who Jesus is and what he did and what the significance of that is. So I feel, in a sense, that makes me feel more free. You know, if he starts quoting the Quran and telling me this and that, then that makes me feel all the more free to pull out the Bible and read a passage to him and talk with him. So, yeah, I guess you could say they kind of do sometimes. The Quran is not translated into local language. I think I read an article recently. I think the Quran, so generally Muslims don't look favorably on translation because they don't think the Arabic original can be translated faithfully. They sometimes will publish what they call interpretations or commentaries. And I think the Quran has only been translated into those sort of interpretations in, I think it's 28 languages in the world, as opposed to the scriptures that have been translated in whole or in portions in over 2,000 languages. So it's very disproportionate. There are not many languages that have the Quran.
So it's kind of KJV only.
Or except that it's also a different language. So, I mean, it's very much the passage from 1 Corinthians talking about the language barrier and how that makes you a foreigner to someone. in Islam, to know God, you have to learn his language as they see it, to learn Arabic. Otherwise, you're just dependent on others. You might memorize the Quran and not even understand what it says. So it's a very different approach, where God comes to us. He's, first of all, comes to us in human language, and then that can also be translated into various languages.
I have read the Quran in English. I did it during my college days, and I had a conversation with someone, a Muslim teacher, about that. And I commented that I had read the Quran. He said, "Oh, you know Arabic?" I said, "No, I read it in English." He said, "Well, then you haven't read it."
Yeah, in Islam, they use the term Allah to refer to God, and in terms of the origins of that word, it comes from the Semitic word for God, the Proto-Semitic word for God, so related to Hebrew El, for instance. But they see that not as just a term for God, but actually as his personal name, not just a title, God, but as his actual personal name. So I think that would be one of the major differences in how we understand that name. And the name Allah is used in Arabic translations of the Bible. It's just a term that refers to God in Arabic, and is the normal term for Arabic-speaking believers to use for God. But they see it as actually his personal name as opposed to Yahweh. Yes. Yeah, there are a couple guys in town that I would consider pretty close friends, particularly my language helper, who are Muslim. Yeah, they would certainly reject that out of hand. Certainly would, yeah, they wouldn't want to hear that at all or believe it in any sense. They would see that as blasphemous. Yeah, I mean, we don't want to be unnecessarily offensive, but there's a certain offense to the gospel for those who don't believe. It's offensive. So we don't try to be offensive overtly, but particularly if they're open to talking about it, we'll say things that they don't agree with, they don't necessarily want to hear, but they need to hear the truth.
So maybe we'll do one more question, and then they can ask you questions over brownies and egg salad sandwiches.
Yeah. Right.
One more
question? Yes. So I grew up in Niger, in southeastern Niger, and this language group is mainly in Chad, but also crosses the border into eastern Niger. And my parents also worked in linguistics, some in translation, with the same language in Niger. So I heard it as a kid. My parents worked with it. I had an interest in it in that sense. When we first were looking for where we might work, a concern of ours was not to just go back to Niger or Chad or somewhere like that because it was what we were familiar with. We wanted to be open to whatever the Lord would call us to. And so we first started looking for opportunities for translation associated with church planting work, so places where there was a church that had been planted but that still needed the scriptures. And we weren't able to find anything like that. And so eventually we came back to looking at working with Dazaga and Chad as a possibility. And we got a lot of encouragement from people who knew us to look at our growing up in Niger, not as a crutch, but as really preparation and a help in moving to Chad for the work there. And we've found that to be certainly the case. All right, thank you for your time.
If anybody... I don't know if anybody's interested in seeing me put this on. I think there was a question about, yes, should I do it up here or should I just, okay. You want to, can you stand by Daddy for a minute? And then when we're done, did we have the pictures and stuff? Yeah.
We do have some family pictures if anyone is interested. I left them out in the van, but I'd be happy to grab those for anyone who might want
a
picture.
And then we have a sign-up sheet if anybody would like to just receive our newsletter to know how to pray for us throughout the years. So there's a couple ways you can do this. I don't usually do it with the baby on front of me. I usually carry babies on the back with a piece of cloth strapped on. So I've never actually done it with him on the front. So there are a couple ways you can do it. So just it's about 5 yards long, this piece of material. So I just tie it in a knot on the side. And usually I have a head tie on my head because this is really slippery and it slips off easily, so I put a head tie on underneath. And then I just bring this around.
Did we hear something in Tathagata language?
Sure. So generally to greet people that ask about your health, they'll say wasi, means are you healthy? And they're not really asking necessarily about your health, it's just what you say, and you always respond waso, I'm healthy. Whether or not you're healthy. It's kind of like we say in English, how are you?
Yeah.
Automatically you say
fine.
Whether or not you're fine. If I were to tell you my name, I would say Surtango Tahar. That means my name is Tahar, which is what they call me there. They calculate age in rainy seasons. And so, for instance, Evsevia is 4 years old. So I would say Nila Huna Tuzo. She has 4 rainy seasons. Yeah.
I'm happy for anybody who'd like to try this on. Welcome to come after me afterwards and try it on if you'd like.
Thank you for coming to share with us.